Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, saying today that he's proceeding to authorize a subpoena for the full unredacted Mueller report, as well as the special counsel's underlying evidence, which Nadler argues in an op-ed in the New York Times published Monday that, quote, "We require the report first because Congress, not the Attorney General, has a duty under the Constitution to determine whether wrongdoing had occurred. It is not the Attorney General's job to step in and substitute his judgment for the special counsel's." Lisa Graves, co-director of Documented and a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department and Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, joins us to discuss whether the April 2nd deadline Democrats set for William Barr to turn over the full Mueller report to Congress will be ignored by Barr, who has promised to deliver his redacted version of the report in mid-April or sooner. With battle lines shaping up over whether the public will get the full report or the one censored by Barr, and since grand jury material, along with sensitive intelligence material, appears to be the primary obstacle to a public release, we will look into why Barr won't have a judge determine the extent of grand jury material which could be made public, as has happened before. Then we'll speak with Jeff Stein, national security correspondent at Newsweek, where he writes the Spy Talk column about the testimony to the House Oversight and Reform Committee by an 18-year veteran of the White House security clearance process, Tricia Newbolt, who revealed that 25 security clearance denials were reversed during the Trump administration. With Chairman Cummings' report about to vote on a subpoena, with Chairman Cummings' committee about to vote on a subpoena on Tuesday to compel testimony from Carl Klein, Newbolt's politically appointed boss who overruled her, it remains uncertain whether the White House will comply. Then finally, we will investigate the most brazen example of Trump putting the fox in charge of the henhouse with the appointment of Rick Scott to head the GOP's healthcare reform effort to replace Obamacare with the Trump promise, quote, "They are going to come up with something really spectacular." Michael Hilsig, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist for the Los Angeles Times, where his latest article is "Trump putting Rick Scott in charge of his healthcare push is a sick joke," joins us to discuss how Scott led a company that paid a $1.7 billion fine, the largest recovery ever reached for defrauding Medicare and Medicaid, meaning the American taxpayer. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
Well, thanks for joining us, Lisa. And tomorrow, do you think tomorrow's going to be a dramatic day? It's the deadline that the Democrats in the Congress have issued for Barr to turn over an unredacted full report, which is actually the way business is done as usual, as far as I know, with previous special counsels. Or do you think he will do what he's doing, hold on to it, and go ahead and do his redactions and hand it in mid-April or sooner, as he's promised?
I don't think Barr will turn over the report, not because he shouldn't, but because he's been hired basically for this job by Trump to be a meddler, to meddle in this investigation, and I think to try to limit the adverse information, the evidence against the president that's provided to Congress. I think that's inappropriate. I think Congress is going to have to go to court. And there's ample precedent to support Congress obtaining the full report. It's unfortunate that Barr is willing to waste time and waste resources in order to delay this and impede the sharing of all these materials with Congress. But I don't think that he's going to be cooperative because he's been hired to be uncooperative. And in fact, he auditioned for the job by attacking the investigation itself. So I don't have high hopes for Barr, not with his recent performance and certainly not with his history and track record of being someone who is, fully willing to be a whitewasher.
So do you see his release of the four-page summary, which so many people, and particularly in the press, treated as though it was the Mueller report, clearly a 400-page report cannot be reflected in four pages. And a lot of people now are realizing that maybe that was Barr's way of shaping the public narrative. Of course, you've got Trump out there claiming exoneration, and the Republicans are all excited about it. And there, and of course, there's some people on the sort of Russiagate skeptic left is also celebrating along with the Republicans.
Well, I think that it was an exceptionally manipulative act on his part. Quite frankly, there were some numbers that were conveyed in that four-page letter, but the one number that was hidden from the public at that moment was that it was a 400-page report, and that's not even counting the appendices and charts and attachments. So it's a very long report. I did the calculation. That's at least 200,000 words, and somehow this man Barr, who was handpicked by Trump to be the attorney general, somehow between the time that the report came in on a Friday, with that voluminous of material evidence, ample evidence, substantial evidence, it sounds like in the area of potential obstruction charges, and a summary of more than 500 witnesses' testimony, interviews that were conducted by 20 attorneys, including Mueller. Interviews that were pursued and conducted by FBI agents and accountants, forensic accountants, that somehow Barr could arrogantly basically convey to himself this authority that within less than 48 hours, he would somehow fully assess all of that evidence and give Trump a talking point to exonerate himself is absurd. It's arrogant. It was manipulative. And I think that it's been damaging. But I think it's going to be damaging for the president once evidence that Mueller's team did obtain is shared with the public. And so it's a bit of a game, I think, on his part to try to set the tone for the consideration of the report. But the fact that it was 400 pages, he did not disclose that when he issued that letter. That was a serious omission, even though it's not a substantive omission. It goes to the heart of what a rush to judgment or a rush to misjudgment Barr was engaged in. And quite frankly, Ian, if there's more going on, if it turns out that there's evidence that Barr has pressured Mueller in any way, that he's tried to walk back or push back or water down even the initial report from Mueller, I think they'll be hell to pay. I think that the American people, the majority of them, are not going to tolerate that sort of manipulation, that sort of pressure, if it in fact has existed on the part of this attorney general.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, the co-director of Undocumented. She served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, a deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as deputy chief of the U.S. courts. Well, we know that Gerald Nadler, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, had a 10-minute conversation with Barr where he tried to convince Barr that he should allow a judge to be appointed to vet the grand jury testimony, which should be redacted or at least protected. And this has happened before where it's been released. So we know that he got turned down in this 10-minute conversation, but we also know that Barr had a private dinner with the Senate Judiciary Chairman, Lindsey Graham, a much more friendly and longer interaction. So there seems already out of the gate a partisanship. And by the way, when Barr was the Attorney General for George H.W. Bush, and he pardoned all of those Iran-Contra people like Weinberger and others who got pardons and were able to skate. At the time, William Safire, a conservative columnist, wrote that Barr is a political hack. So there's a whiff of that at the moment. But just address the grand jury issue. That is something that could be solved, should it not? And the fact that Barr's refused to and insists on redacting that himself along with intelligence material and anything that could be harmful to any other person, which is a, you could drive a Mack truck through that one. So what's going on?
Well, I think that Chairman Nadler is fully within his rights to demand and insist that that report fully be conveyed to the House Judiciary Committee. I think it's certainly appropriate if there are, you know, pending cases. There's a few that are still pending where there might need to be some material that is segregated or separated out in a particular way. But the Judiciary Committee has a right to all this material, as does the Intelligence Committee on both sides of Congress. I think that what you see here, as you mentioned, is this partisanship of Barr, his cozy relationship with the White House through his family and his past, along with his solicitousness toward the Republicans. He's acting inappropriately for an attorney general. He's not acting as the nation's top law enforcement officer, but he's acting the way that Trump has wanted an attorney general to be, which is to be almost as if he's his lawyer doing his bidding, try to advance his cause and his case. I think that's inappropriate for the attorney general. And I do think that William Safire, although I didn't agree with him, have not agreed with him very much over the great expanse of time. I think that unfortunately Barr's history is one of having this political hack behavior, this political subservience, putting politics above the law. And in the case of Iran-Contra, it's not that the president, that George W. Herbert Walker Bush did not have the power to pardon under the Constitution. It's that it was inappropriate, I think. And if I had been in such a role, I think it would have been appropriate to step aside and not go along with such a decision, given the seriousness of the crimes that people were convicted of in that Iran-Contra scandal that damaged the United States. And so here you have someone who has that history, who's already aided previously with the sort of effort to set the rule of law aside to serve political ends. And he's doing that again in spades here.
So along with Gerald Nadler authorizing a subpoena, which will probably come out in a couple of days, from what I understand, it's subpoenaing Barr to hand over the full unredacted Mueller report. The House Judiciary Committee is also voting to authorize subpoenas for five top White House staffers: Don McGahn, Steve Bannon, Hope Hicks, Reince Priebus, and Ann Donaldson. What do you think is going to happen here? Because so far the White House has been incredibly uncooperative. So are they going to draw out these subpoena battles?
Well, I'm not sure how much the White House has a real say over Don McGahn's appearance since he's left the White House. Don McGahn and Ann Donaldson, you know, worked previously with sort of the Koch network. I don't know if she's actually still there. I have to double check. But McGahn brought her in when he was White House counsel. I'm sure this White House will try to object in any way it possibly can and drag its feet and delay allowing people to go before the committees. Congress has an absolute, a right under the Constitution to be conducting these investigations and to call witnesses forward and to issue subpoenas to compel their testimony if they are recalcitrant. And so that's what this Congress is going to do. And I'm hopeful that this Congress will be able to shed light on these matters for the American people. The American people have been waiting for a long time for real answers about the real evidence here. And quite frankly, when you look at just that 4-page letter from Barr, one of the things that struck me was how narrow the first investigation was limited in terms of whether the administration was basically aiding in the hacking of the DNC headquarters to distort that election. Off the table, not part of that examination, are a whole set of activities by Trump, by his agents, including Trump's efforts to be cozy with Putin in order to advance the Trump Tower, other significant issues of potential corruption and abuse of power by Trump and by his son-in-law or his son in terms of their business dealings. And so it's very clear that what the charge that Mueller was given was very narrow regarding Russia. And so I don't think people should be celebrating exoneration at all. There's a very narrow question presented, and there's a lot more questions that need to be answered for the sake of our national security and for the sake of our democracy.
Well, I take it that the people that the Judiciary Committee are subpoenaing, McGahn, Bannon, Hopex, Ryan's previous, and Donaldson, all of them are out of the White House. So that, I take it, means that the White House can't really obstruct that. But these five subpoenas are tied, apparently, to the committee's investigation into corruption, obstruction of justice, and abuse of power. And that began last month, along with the request to a total of 81 individuals and entities. So that is something that they've cast a pretty wide net. And you're telling us that the White House can only kind of hardball when it comes to somebody that's actually serving in the White House. Is that the situation?
From a legal standpoint, I mean, they can certainly assert some sort of executive privilege or ask that those witnesses assert an executive privilege, in essence, on behalf of this White House. So far, it's been interesting when you've seen these other administration officials or former officials come up to testify. They have tried to assert executive privilege without saying those words out loud. So I have no doubt that this White House is going to be trying to impose a very expansive view of executive privilege in terms of what those witnesses could testify to. But I also think it's a different equation in some respects when the person no longer works at the White House. Not that there aren't privilege issues to navigate, but I don't think that it's as there's as much power, in essence. Don McGahn was, I think, very concerned about his legal jeopardy. You could tell from the conversations that he, in essence, made public or that were made public on his behalf in the news. And so I think that it seems likely that he will want to testify truthfully about what he knows, given the jeopardy he appeared to have been facing with this White House's activities.
Well, we know that he testified for 35 hours to Mueller, which again flies in the face of Barr's 4-page letter that basically said, you know, no collusion or conspiracy to defraud the U.S., which is the actual term, they punt on obstruction of justice, not enough corrupt intent, but on the other hand, not a free pass. So that was the best he could do. 35 hours of testimony itself would indicate something was going on, don't you think?
I think so. And also, I think the other part about that 4-page letter is, in some ways, it's too clever by half. If you read that letter closely, Barr's letter, what it in essence says is because Trump was not guilty of working with Russia on interference, therefore, he did not have, in essence, any stake that would give him the negative intent to obstruct. Well, that's just a ridiculous interpretation of the law, quite frankly. You can tell from Trump's own words he was trying to shut down that investigation. He clearly had peril. He instructed his son to lie about the Trump Tower meeting with representatives from Russia. And he also obviously was trying to protect one of his other allies, the person who he designated as the National Security Advisor, the United States of America. And so the idea that just because there's a narrow no on the first question in the investigation of Mueller doesn't mean that Trump could not possibly have the intent to obstruct. I think that's a terribly distorted description of what the law is for obstruction of justice.
So, I know this is like a betting question, but what do you think the odds are that we'll see a full report? I mean, they could, you know, with this guy Barr censoring it, you know, you could end up with something that's more black than visible and shredded. But I would think that most people won't stand for that. Do you think we'll ever see the full report, or at least those that that should be seeing it will see the full report?
I think that the House Intelligence Committee with Adam Schiff is going to see that full report, even the information that's claimed to be of national security import because of the mandate and jurisdiction of that committee. And I would anticipate that Congressman Schiff would do his best to make as much of that public as possible. Mm-hmm. If there are really some sensitive matters that go to sources and methods that need to be protected, that would be extremely narrow. I don't trust Barr at all. I don't have confidence in his neutrality in his devotion to the rule of law to entrust him with redacting anything. I wouldn't entrust him to redact an ordinary FOIA, let alone something of this magnitude, given his bias and his interest in defending Trump.
But you just mentioned Adam Schiff. If he's the key guy in terms of getting the full report unredacted, that would explain to me why these junkyard dogs on the Republican side of the House Intelligence Committee are going after him on Trump's instructions. It's very clear that Trump wants to neutralize Adam Schiff. He's afraid of Adam Schiff. Is that why he's afraid of Adam Schiff?
I think so. I mean, it's an extraordinary attack that's being launched against him. When Devin Nunes, who is up to all sorts of no good as the head of that committee when Republicans led Congress, was protected by these other Republicans because Devin Nunes was trying to aid the White House, trying to protect the White House at any cost, even though he had oversight over the intelligence community of the United States of America. The fact is that Adam Schiff is an honorable person. He's someone who has investigated Russian issues before when he was working as a prosecutor. He's someone who's extremely smart. He's extremely devoted to the rule of law. And he's a very... he would be a very difficult adversary for someone like Trump. Not that Nadler isn't. Nadler is a very formidable force, a very devoted person. But the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee is different from the Intelligence Committee in terms of some of those components, if there are indeed sources and methods of material that might be, or sources and methods that might be revealed somehow in the report that Mueller submitted.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having me on, and good luck at the center next week. I'm sure it's going to be a great conversation.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I'm looking forward to it. And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, the co-director of Documented. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as deputy chief for the U.S. courts. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the White House whistleblower revealed 25 clearance denials were overruled. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jeff Stein, national security correspondent at Newsweek, where he writes the Spy Talk column, a Washington-based editor and investigative reporter specializing in U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy. In 2005, he launched Spy Talk as a weekly column at the Congressional Quarterly before it moved to the Washington Post in 2007, and is the author of A Murder in Wartime, the untold spy story that changed the course of the Vietnam War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Stein.
Thanks a lot, Ian. Nice to be here.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And what do you make of the release of testimony from Tricia Newbold, a longtime White House security advisor? She told the House Oversight and Reform Committee that there were dozens, in fact, 25 to be exact, denials of security clearance applications that were later approved, essentially overruled by the president. And we know that the former White House Chief of Staff General Kelly wrote a letter for the record objecting to this move by Trump to override the intelligence professionals. And I believe Don McGahn, the White House counsel, also wrote a memo of disapproval for the record as well. So you spent a lot of time with intelligence people. My understanding is that they don't stick their necks out and end their careers by going toe-to-toe with the President of the United States.
Well, in this case, it wasn't an intelligence person, someone from the intelligence community that stuck their neck out. It was a career federal employee Not all the White House employees are political appointees. There's a staff that stays there year in and year out. And she was the complainant here, or the whistleblower, was a longtime federal employee. And Tricia Newbold, who is the whistleblower in this case, had complained months ago and had filed, I think, an Equal Opportunity Commission discrimination complaint that the official she worked for, who was a political appointee, had taken advantage of her dwarfism. You know, it speaks volumes that she had been so successful in her career while suffering from this condition. And he started putting files out of her reach on tall file cabinets and other places where she couldn't reach them. So she had to ask him to get these reports. And, of course, that allowed him to suss out exactly what she was looking for. At the same time, months ago, she had complained, according to her lawyer back then, that she had raised several questions about the security clearance process in the White House and had specifically objected, had become specifically upset over clearances given to people who she and her office thought were not worthy of the trust of the United States in handling documents. And the list of her complaints about these people getting security clearances is quite astounding. The reason they were denied security clearances was because of, quote, foreign influence, conflicts of interest, personal conduct, financial problems, drug use, and criminal conduct. Now, that's why these people were not getting security clearances. But Trump intervened, or an agent of Trump in the White House intervened, to demand that they be given security clearances. And top among them, among these officials, is Jared Kushner, who has all sorts of foreign entanglements, financial entanglements, political entanglements, financial problems. So she seemed to be on firm ground, let me put it that way, in making her complaints known. She said she went to the Congress to make her complaints because she wasn't getting any traction inside the White House.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeff Steiner, the National Security Correspondent at Newsweek, where he writes the Spy Talk column, a Washington-based editor and investigative reporter specializing in U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy. In 2005, he launched Spy Talk as a weekly column at the Congressional Quarterly before it moved to the Washington Post in 2007, and he's the author of A Murder in Wartime, the untold spy story that changed the course of the Vietnam War. Well, we already know that Jared Kushner, during the transition period, I believe it was on December the 10th or 12th, he secretly met with the Russian ambassador Kislyak and the head of the VNB Bank, otherwise known as Putin's slush fund, at which apparently Kushner asked for a back channel between the White House and the Kremlin, and also he asked the banker for $500 million to bail out 666 Fifth Avenue. Now, we know about that from intercepts. So what is your understanding, Jeff Stein, of what they have in terms of intelligence on these people who were denied clearances? What kind of intercepts or evidence do they have, particularly of the charge about compromise from a foreign power?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think we really know how much came from secret intercepts, which would have required a FISA warrant. That's a warrant from the secret court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, which vets requests from the government to electronically intercept the conversations of its targets. We don't know, at least I don't know offhand, whether Kushner was the subject of one of those warrants. But we do know from just press accounts that he was having meetings with foreign officials. We know from public records who bought 666 Fifth Avenue. We know of his confidential meetings with Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, from press accounts. So not a lot of this is really secret. It's out in the open. And I must say that extends to the president himself. I'm not the first to say that it's highly doubtful if Donald Trump was an ordinary citizen applying for a security clearance, that he would probably be denied it because of his own arrangements and contacts with Russian officials. Of course, we know that he hid his contacts with Russian individuals over building Trump Tower in Moscow. But he had many contacts with Russians before that. Russians were laundering money through Trump Tower and other properties by buying and overpaying for condos. His longtime associations with organized crime figures. So Donald Trump himself would most likely be denied a security clearance unless he had an angel like a President Trump to make sure he got a security clearance. The White House has been rife with questionable, with appointees with questionable backgrounds and foreign ties, financial problems, personal conduct officials. One of the chief secretaries of the president was forced out because of two incidents of beating his wives. We don't know much about drug use among White House officials, but I could make some guesses, but I won't make them on the air. So also the reference here is that she reported instances of criminal conduct by White House appointees who were seeking security clearances, and she was overruled by White House officials on that. So it seems like it's a virtual Rikers Island of shady characters working at the White House who were granted security clearances over the protestations of the career officials responsible for the security of the United States.
And this career official who's now the whistleblower, she was an 18-year veteran of this White House office. Her boss, Carl Klein, as you mentioned, Jeff Stein was a political appointee as the director of personnel security at the White House. He's now apparently at the Pentagon, but apparently the Democrats want to subpoena him. They also want to look into what happened with the clearances for that were obviously overruled by the president, for Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump, and the National Security Advisor, John Bolton. And apparently, Newbold complained to her boss about overriding her recommendations, and he told her to basically stop disqualifying these people and get with the program. So what's going on with Bolton? Because that, is he compromised in any way, do you think?
I have no idea whether Bolton is compromised. Unless it emerges that he was involved in some sort of foreign intrigue. You remember that Michael Flynn, the first national security advisor, very briefly national security advisor, was involved with foreigners and nuclear officials in trying this, to get this private program to export nuclear power to the Middle East. And that was one of the reasons he was forced out, and is still a subject of investigation by Democratic-controlled committees on the Hill. The bottom line, I think, to all this is that, again, this is just another example of sort of the abnormal behavior of this administration. Part of it, I think, stems from the fact that these guys were real outsiders, and they didn't really understand how government works. Government is a big grinding machine, and it takes things like security clearances pretty seriously. So when you sort of enter the system, in other words, you accept an appointment to the White House, you are going to be caught up in the machine. It's going to look at your background, and it's going to vet your behavior. And it's going to spit you out if you don't pass muster. But these guys, you have some problems like this in every administration, but nothing to this degree as in this administration. It just proves it once again that these guys do not recognize governmental norms. When career government officials do their job, to keep criminals and other people who are vulnerable to blackmail, that's the thing here, vulnerable to blackmail out of the White House, they're overruled by the political officials, starting with the president. And that should concern anyone who's interested in the security of the United States. It's a big problem here.
Well, but just on that came up on literally the first week that Trump was in office. The acting attorney general, Sally Yates, went to the White House and said, look, we're concerned that General Flynn, the national security advisor, had lied to the vice president. And we think he's compromised by the Russians and he's subject to blackmail. So this has been out there for some time. My understanding is that there's some concern that Bolton may be compromised by the Russians. Nothing came up on your radar about that? Nothing about the Plato Club or whatever that was called?
Nothing for me personally yet. And I wouldn't want to speak to rumors that have been floating up.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I mean, it's news if a White House official is not entangled with some foreign government or officials or some foreign intrigue. We've seen this from the very beginning, like, as you pointed out, Michael Flynn, Trump himself and his lawyer, Fixer Cohen, trying to do a secret deal in Moscow right in the middle of the presidential campaign. So this White House has been rife with foreign intrigue right from the campaign onward. And finding somebody who isn't tarred is a challenge right now.
So how do you think the Democrats are going to proceed with these subpoenas? The White House has not been cooperative. They want to find out why Jared and Ivanka and Bolton got their clearances, and they also want to subpoena Klein. So what are the chances?
Well, they're going to get these votes because they control the House committees. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't foresee circumstances in which they would not get the committee votes to approve subpoenas, since they now control them. So,
right. But whether the White House will cooperate, that would be the real question, surely.
Well, I doubt the White House will cooperate.
Right.
I think the White House will stonewall and say, let's go to court so we can drag this out.
Well, Jeff Stein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me in.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Stein, who's a national security correspondent at Newsweek, where he writes the Spy Talk column, a Washington-based editor and investigative reporter specializing in U.S. intelligence, defense, and foreign policy. In 2005, he launched Spy Talk as a weekly column at Congressional Quarterly before it moved to the Washington Post in 2007. And he's the author of A Murder in Wartime, the untold spy story that changed the course of the Vietnam War. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Trump's most brazen act of putting the fox in charge of the hen house with the appointment of Governor Rick Scott, famous for defrauding Medicare and Medicaid for $1.7 billion, now in charge of replacing Obamacare with Trump Care.
Listen, do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell?
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Hiltzik, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry, and currently he writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, which covers business and economic issues relevant to life in California. And he is the author of The New Deal, A Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Trump Putting Rick Scott in Charge of His Healthcare Push is a Sick Joke. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzik.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be back with you.
Well, thanks, Michael. And in terms of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank, or the fox in charge of the chicken house, whatever analogy you want to use, that has been a pretty persistent critique of Trump's cabinet picks But this one appears to be even more outrageous. How would you rate it?
Well, as I wrote in my column this morning, what I said was that, you know, if we keep in mind that Trump's policy seems to be to put the worst people in charge of agencies and policies and to pick the worst, this one goes beyond that to the level of self-parody. So, yeah, when you said putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank, I think that was a perfectly fair assessment.
Well, the point is that Rick Scott's company, Columbia HCA, which he ran until, 1997, was the subject of, according to the Justice Department, by far the largest recovery ever reached by the government in a healthcare fraud investigation. That we're talking about $1.7 billion was clawed back by the government from Rick Scott's company. And he, of course, went on to become the governor of Florida. And now he's the newly elected senator from Florida, which is extraordinary. So how does a man with that kind of record keep getting rewarded politically and now by the president as his point man for what Trump's talking about as his replacement for the Affordable Care Act?
Well, in terms of, you know, how somebody like this gets elected and reelected, you know, he was elected twice as Florida governor, then he was now, as you said, he's just been elected Florida senator. We have to look into the minds of Florida voters who, for some unaccountable reason, keep electing this guy. Although, you know, it was pretty close, at least the Senate race was fairly close. The Columbia HCA scandal, it was a massive fraud. Scott was CEO. Certainly, for some of the time that this was going on, he resigned as CEO about 4 months after the federal investigation was announced in 1997, and then he was gone when the settlements, there was a settlement in 2000 and another one a few years later. The company pleaded guilty for fraud, something like 12 or 14 counts. Scott was not personally charged, and he sort of skated on it, and amazingly, he keeps bringing up his management of this company over and over again without ever mentioning that, you know, that it was unbelievably fraudulent. But, you know, as recently as Sunday, he was on Face the Nation on CBS. He said, look, I ran one of the biggest healthcare companies in the country, so I know what I'm talking about. And, of course, the interviewer from CBS didn't say, yes, but it was a fraud. But that's the case.
Well, let's go through some of the frauds that Columbia HCA under Scott were fined for and paid a record $1.7 billion fine. They billed Medicare and Medicaid and other federal programs for tests that were not necessary or ordered by physicians. The company attached false diagnosis codes to patient records to increase reimbursements to the hospitals. The company illegally claimed non-reimbursable marketing and advertising costs as community education. And Columbia billed the government for home health care visits for patients who did not qualify to receive them. So this is stealing from the public trough. This is stealing from you and me and everybody listening.
Yes, this was a full menu of all the ways that a hospital company can defraud payers. And in this case, the payers were the federal government, and the victims in the scheme were Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, which provides health care to the military, and then the federal program that at the time provided health care to federal employees. So, yes, you know, the list that you just gave is exactly, this is what they pleaded guilty to. They would upcode, that is, they would claim that a treatment for a patient that carried a higher reimbursement than the treatment they actually delivered. They would file claims for things they didn't provide. They would file claims for treatments that weren't indicated. It was the whole ball of wax, and Columbia HCA was basically doing all of it.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Hiltzik, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry, and he currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, which covers business and economic issues relevant to life in California. And his latest book is The New Deal, A Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Trump putting Rick Scott in charge of his healthcare push is a sick joke. But subsequent to him in 1997 leaving Columbia HCO before it was fined the largest fine in history in terms of healthcare fraud, and the fraud, of course, is against the American people and the taxpayers. He then, as we mentioned, got elected twice as governor of Florida and now was narrowly elected the new senator. But let's talk about his tenure in Florida. Hasn't it been disastrous for healthcare? I understand that Florida is now, what, third from the bottom in terms of the health of its citizens?
Right. You know, under Rick Scott's management, Florida was bad and got worse. He refused to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, even though at least one house of his legislature had actually voted to do so. He basically essentially blocked it, or at least he threw in his lot with the opponents. And as a result, Florida's health metrics went down. In the CDC, which is a federal government, in 2017 counted Florida's uninsured rate at more than 20%. That made it the worst in the nation, except for Georgia and Texas, which is not a club you really want your state to be a member of. Healthcare metrics, including metrics for women, declined while he was in charge. Basically, he had an opportunity to add coverage to 800,000 Floridians through Medicaid, and he turned it down. He basically turned up his nose at billions of dollars in federal funding, obviously for ideological reasons. This had nothing to do with any interest in improving the health of his residents. It was really just to show his bona fides as a right-wing conservative.
And Donald Trump is touting his appointment to head up this team to replace the Affordable Care Act with something spectacular that Trump talks about. And of course, the other two are Senators Barrasso of Wyoming and Bill Cassidy of Louisiana. I think Cassidy's a doctor, isn't he?
They're both doctors.
They're
actually
both doctors. Yeah.
And you know, Cassidy, he was last heard of putting forth an Obamacare repeal and replace plan that would have cost millions of Americans their health coverage. Barrasso is just sort of a garden variety right-wing anti-ACA character. He's from Wyoming, where, you know, apparently they don't care about their constituents' health much.
Well, I interviewed an author recently. He wrote a book called Dying of Whiteness. He's both a psychiatrist and a medical doctor at Vanderbilt in Tennessee. And he went around and did research, talked to a lot of people. And one of the characters in his book is a guy dying of hepatitis who voted for Trump and voted for the politicians in Tennessee who refused Medicaid expansion in the same way that Rick Scott did in Florida. And the author, psychiatrist, doctor, says to this Tennessean, look, right next door in Kentucky, you could move there and you'd get treatment and you wouldn't die. So why do you vote for these people who essentially, you know, are meting out your death sentence? And he said, I'm not going to have my tax dollars go to Mexicans. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that is an insight into all people who vote against their own interest on health care. But have you ever figured out why it is? You would think that the average person would actually be in favor of having good health care, because everybody in their lives, whether it's their lives or the lives of their family members, at one point or other, have to be faced with health problems and they have to be dealt with. So you'd think universally people would be in favor of health care, not against it. That's just...
Yeah, there are a couple of interesting phenomena going on here. First of all, what's interesting about the Affordable Care Act is that it's become more popular as the attacks by Republicans and Trump have intensified. It's now more than 50%. There's more than 50% approval among the American public for the Affordable Care Act. It took a while to get there, but people clearly who are beneficiaries of it understand what it has, how it has helped them. Now, the other side of the coin is, you know, your basic question is, why do people continually vote against their own interests? And, you know, this is a debate that I think political scientists have been having for years and years and years. What's going to be interesting is whether Trump's claim that he's going to bring us a spectacularly great health program is going to be heard by the public, because he's been talking this way all along, and the Republicans have not put forth a single workable plan for health care, certainly nothing to replace the ACA, in 9 years since the ACA was enacted. They've just sort of run against it rhetorically and tried to kill it. And Trump is in there with both hands trying to do the same thing. Why anybody would believe that he's going to, you know, produce something great, especially with these three Republicans, is, I don't understand it. I don't pretend to understand it. All I can do is point out how wrong it is.
Well, do you have an understanding, Michael Hilsick, of Trump's thinking? If you've got this team of grifters in his cabinet, or, you know, some of them are just appalling, like Acosta, the guy that got the child rapist, child sex trafficker, Epstein, off, and, you know, you go through the list, new designate for Interior has proven to have enormous conflicts of interest in terms of being industry friendly against the endangering the health of Americans through approving pesticides that are carcinogenic, etc. You could go through the whole list of them. So this guy, Scott, is definitely the most in-your-face, insulting example of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank. So is Trump a sadist? How would you diagnose his attitude to the American people, that not so much his base, but the majority who are not happy with his governance or lack thereof?
Well, that would presuppose that he knows what he's doing. I think, you know, he's motivated by a desire to knock down what his predecessor achieved, and that's obviously Obamacare. And, you know, the second side of the coin is that he wants to appeal to what he thinks is his base, which, you know, is sort of a garden variety anti-government, anti-immigrant base, but he certainly hasn't extended or expanded his voting base. So I don't really know. I mean, I hope I never have to understand what he's doing, because that would really, you know, sort of expose me to a very dark side of the psyche.
Well, but will this work then? This idea of putting these people in charge of a health care plan that doesn't exist, and Trump doesn't have one, and he's more or less punting on this, isn't he, expecting them to come up with one based upon Scott's performance on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday. He doesn't have a plan, and you say that Senator Cassidy had a plan, but it would put millions more uninsured, get rid of coverage for pre-existing conditions, etc. So is there anything out there, or is it beyond Trump's promises? Is there any meat on the bone anywhere?
No, there's no meat on the bone. Nobody's got a plan. When Rick Scott appeared on CBS over the weekend, he started talking as though Trump was going to come up with a plan, and then he and his colleagues in the Senate would push it. But of course, what Trump said is that these guys are going to come up with a plan. So they're pointing fingers at each other. Nobody's got a plan. The Republicans have, you know, they've had a decade. They haven't come up with a plan, and they're going to come into the next election empty-handed. And it's really going to be up to the Democrats, who I think the Democrats think they've been given a gift here, because Republicans did not want to run on health care again. They did it last year, and they got creamed at the polls for the very same reason that voters understood that they don't have a plan, and that if we don't have Democrats in charge, you know, everybody's health care is at risk. So I don't know. They're doubling down on a bad hand, and, you know, we'll know more, you know, in a year and a half. whether it works.
And in the meantime, how endangered is the Affordable Care Act? I mean, this court, taking it to the courts, well, is pretty...
You know, the backdrop of all this is that, you know, a right-wing Texas federal judge bought basically an argument from some right-wing state governors and attorneys general that the Affordable Care Act should be overturned because of, you know, the tax cut bill. And it's sort of a convoluted argument, which I don't really want to bore your listeners with, but no legitimate lawyer or legal expert believes this is a legitimate position for a judge to have. His ruling is now before an appeals court, and the Trump administration last week basically bailed out on it. They said, we're not going to support, basically they said, we believe the Affordable Care Act should be overturned on the grounds that these states brought up. But it's being defended in court by a coalition of 19 states, including California. The legal basis for the claim is very, very thin. But you never know. Look, you know, judges can do weird things. And the question is, if the ACA does get overturned, where will we be? And that's a position that's a question that Trump has not been able to answer.
And William Barr, the Attorney General, it was totally AWOL when, as far as the Justice Department is concerned, they are the ones who took a walk.
Well, not only Barr, but Alex Azar, who's the Secretary of Health and Human Services, both of them were silent. I mean, this is a position that Trump essentially ordered the Department of Justice to take. Neither Barr nor Azar spoke out against it in public. They both claim through their microphones that they spoke out against it in private, but as I've been writing, that doesn't count. You know, if you're the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Attorney General of the United States and you think something's wrong, it's your responsibility to say so publicly, not say so in private and then, you know, throw up your hands when you lose the battle.
Well, it doesn't augur well for Barr's control of the Mueller report, so we will see, I guess. I thank you for joining us, Michael Hilsing.
Well, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
And again, I may speak with Michael Hilsing, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry and currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. And he's the author of The New Deal and Modern History. And his latest article at the Los Angeles Times is Trump Putting Rick Scott in Charge of His Healthcare Push is a Sick Joke. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.